Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4 by 5 color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5. For the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out, www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output. But they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks, the community for analog photography, www.apug.org, and of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in the museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it, they have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. On today's program, join us again, our good buddy, Ron Mowry. Ron's going to talk today about what he's been up to. There's some brand new products that he's helped develop that you can get at the formulary, and just see what's going on with Ron. Ron, how you doing today, buddy?
Just fine. How are you, Scott?
Great. Thanks for joining us here again on Inside Analog Photo. Always great to have you with us, and I think we have some really cool stuff to talk about today. You've been doing a lot of development work and doing a lot of stuff with these great people over at the formulary. And you have some cool stuff to talk about today.
Well, yeah, I'm going to try to avoid advertising stuff, but I'll tell you, we've developed a new developer, Liquidol, which is an equivalent to Dectol, except it has longer shelf life and longer tray life than the standard liquid Dectol or the Dectol dilute. We're working on two new fixers and a line of emulsion-making products that'll assist people if they wish to make silver halide in gelatin. So I'm prepared to talk about those, and Bud's agreed that I can kind of pre-announce a couple of the products.
Well, let's talk about the developer. This is a big thing here. I mean, how often do you see people coming out with new developers?
Not really very often, because they're pretty standard. This developer uses a technology that we developed at Kodak, which relies very heavily not on synergy, like you may hear about the Mitol hydroquinone developers. It requires what's called electron transport, where you have a very large quantity of an inactive developing agent and a very tiny quantity of a recyclable developing agent. and these pump each other back and forth. Therefore, due to the fact that they can work together back and forth, not in synergy, but just in transporting electrons, in that solution, it keeps the developer alive for a long time. That's the principle behind it. Bill Troop and I worked for about 2 years to refine the formula. The first couple of formulas didn't look too good, and we finally got it right, and now it's on sale. Bill and I have now redirected our attention to a very high acuteness fine grain developer, which we're working on. It will probably take us another 2 years to get it to fruition. That's where we stand right now. We're trying to use as advanced a technology as possible.
So let's talk about the regular Dectol developer that people have been using for many, many years and what some of the attributes are of this new development that you put together with this research you did at Konak to bring this together now to make this developer that lasts longer. Am I going to get the same type of contrast, the same type of development I would from the standard product? And is this just mainly for shelf life, or how does this work out?
Okay, it gives approximately the same tone as regular Dectol. It's diluted one part of concentrate to nine parts of water. It gives a slightly more open shoulder than Dectol, in my opinion. But this would depend on the paper you use and whether the paper has incorporated developers or not. As for its biggest attribute, let's say that you have 11 by 14 tray filled to the brim, and you're going to run off a batch of 100 identical prints. Chances are the Dectol will season in more rapidly and change than the Liquidol will. That's one of its attributes. Or if you just want to run 5 or 6 prints today, and 5 or 6 tomorrow, and 5 or 6 the day after, Dectol, you will begin to detect a change on the third day. But with Liquidol, you can still get the same result on the third day. In fact, I've gotten good results out to about 120 to 240 hours in an open tray with Liquidol. But I certainly don't recommend that being used. It's just an indication of how long it'll last.
Wow, so this is a long time. You guys put a lot of effort in developing this product.
Yes, we did. There were hundreds upon hundreds of prints run to test the capacity and the longevity of the developer. And it was compared against many, many different developers that are currently on the market.
Ron, what kind of work that stemmed out of Konak when you were there that helped develop this new technology that you're using in this new developer?
Actually, it was developed for the instant film product. The electron transport relied on a developer in the pod and a type of developer in the coating, which was attached to a die. And they would transfer electrons back and forth, releasing a dye molecule, and the developer would go on developing throughout the coating, but the dye would transfer over and terminate the reaction. So I kind of latched onto that and said, hey, look, we could use a mix of two different developing agents, one of them in high concentration, one of them practically zero concentration for all practical purposes, and we might get a good reaction. Bill and I played with the formula, as I say, for quite a while, and bingo, up we came with the formula. And now Bud's selling it.
Now, what type of environment does it take to develop this type of chemistry? This is pretty high-end stuff.
Actually, it is a pretty ordinary solution. I don't feel comfortable divulging the details.
Well, of course not. We don't want to do that.
That's actually, for all intents and purposes, a rather dilute developer solution with a high concentration of one developing agent and very little of another. So you might consider it to be close to a normal developer otherwise.
But this all stems from the work you did at Konak, and you guys spent years researching this stuff for the instant film work. So I think that it wasn't that you guys just threw together a little bit of a cocktail here and in a few months you cranked out a developer. You spent years on this work to get this type of technology to work together.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I worked on instant products, I was not one of the players in that particular part of the chemistry. I was involved in latex timing layer and the acidification layers and the shutdown chemistry. But I was fully aware of all of the rest of the chemistry because it went on all around me in all the different offices and with all the different engineers and in all the meetings. So I was sitting there saying, aha, ooh, this is nice, neat. Besides which, having Grant Haste as person to bounce ideas off wasn't any small thing either.
No, definitely. I bet the guys at the Impossible Project would love to have you helping them.
I've probably forgotten too much to be of any use. You know that? I don't remember any of the chemistry. Try as I might, I had to go back and look at one of the patents to remember what I was doing back then. So it's like 1980, 82, something like that.
Right. So these patents that you had that were in conjunction with Kodak are basically out of force now because it's been longer than 17 years, right?
Oh, all of that stuff's all free to use. And in fact, I used a different enough approach that I couldn't myself find any overlap with any of the existing patent work.
Wow, this is great stuff. I mean, this is really going to help people out, I think, that are in a working environment where they don't have to mix up a batch every time they want to develop something. I mean, they can just leave it around for a day or two and just sort of keep working through things without having to keep using up fresh chemical.
Yeah. In fact, I've worked on that same thing with fixers, which I'd like to talk to you about when we get through with this.
Definitely.
So, okay. You might be interested in hearing about that.
Oh, of course. We're always interested in hearing what you're up to because you always have something good that's cooking that really surprises people, and you're always working on really cool stuff. So, of course, we would always like to hear what Ron's up to. So let's talk about this developer. So this new developer, it's available from who? Where do people find out about this stuff?
It's available from the Photographer's Formulary in Condon, Montana. It's also available from several of their distributors. I don't have the pricing information on it here, but you can give Sherry a call at their toll-free number and order it right now.
So it's available today?
Yep.
Is it on the website yet?
Oh, yeah, it's there on the website.
Great. Very, very cool. So this is going to be going out, so I'm sure we're going to hear lots of great feedback. And I think this is very cool to keep costs down, especially in this economic environment. If you can use a developer that's going to last longer, I mean, this is great.
That was our feeling. It costs a little more to make, but it has a lot of capacity and a lot of longevity, and that should all even out and give you a little break in cost.
Sure. So let's talk about this new fixer.
Okay, TF5. It is about to be released. The word I had from Sherry was that it was going to be in their catalog last week, but it turned out that there was a misprint in the data sheets, and we had to go back and edit them, and I think they're still being worked on. I talked to Bud Friday, that's Bud Wilson, the owner of the formulary, and he said they were going to work diligently on them and try to get it out the door with an announcement next week, or maybe the week after. TF5 compared to TF4. TF4 is currently their biggest seller, and it is a super fix. I use it myself. It's great. TF5, though, is designed to overcome some users' objections to it. First off, TF4 has a sediment in the bottom. TF5 does not. Secondly, TF4 has a slight ammonia odor. TF5 has no odor at all, so it's odorless. So basically, you're going to get a fix which is odorless, clear, and you can mix up as much of it or as little of it at a time that you want. So those are the big advantages. I don't know where the cost is going to come in on this, but I can say that it's going to be very cost effective because, among other things, let me tell you one of the tests I did. I set it out in a tray and fixed with it, and it fixed just fine. I let it evaporate to a solid, which most photographers don't want to do.
Right.
And then I poured in a beaker of water right back to the original level, and everything redissolved, and it's still fixed. I have been doing this evaporation over a roughly 6-month period, and it's still fixing in a tray. It's not oxidizing. It's not turning cloudy. I've got the first bottle of it that we had is about a year old now. The first trial mix I made here that I've kept that I didn't use up totally, and it's still good. So I'm saying that shelf life for TF5 in your darkroom should be at least 1 to 2 years in the original bottle. And in the tray is going to be up to, I will say conservatively, 3 months in the tray. And it'll still work as long as you haven't exhausted it totally.
Wow, that's amazing. It's completely dissolved and all the moisture evaporate out of it. And
yep,
add a little water to it and it makes itself happy again.
Yeah, it makes itself happy. It dissolves. You got to make sure you dissolve it all, of course, but yeah, it works, and it is about to come out. I guess I've covered the advantages there. All of the instructions for use are identical to TF4. We've tried to keep everything the same. The only thing we've changed in the instructions are that you're allowed to use either a running water rinse after development or a stop bath. This is true for TF4, too. You can use a stop bath, but it's not in the instructions. It's going to be a direct drop-in for TF4 with two big advantages, maybe three. That depends on how it costs out in Bud's hands.
Wow, that's great.
Now, we have another fixer under development. It's been going on for almost 4 years now because it's a very difficult fixer. It uses completely new technology. We call it Super Universal Fix. It is now in its 8th revision, and basically it uses a unique gelatin swelling ingredient to get ultra-rapid wash with the minimum amount of water. So it is essentially TF5 with a swelling agent that promotes rapid washing. So if you imagine TF5 being identical to TF4, Super Universal Fix is the same as that, but it's more concentrated, so you can dilute it more, and it washes out more rapidly, so you can have faster wash. The only thing I want to caution people about, though, is that because it has a swelling agent in, if you misuse Super Universal Fix, you can reticulate your film or paper. So you have to use the instructions exactly. And to get the right wash, because of the different types of municipal water supplies around the country, you have to test your film and paper to make sure the washing and fixing are carried out right. It's an extremely fast fix. It's an extremely fast washable fix.
So how much time do you figure you're going to save on your fix cycle?
I've measured as much as 50% compared to TF5. But, as I said, this is dependent on the type of water, how fast the water flows. If you use an archival wash device versus a tray, you're going to get different rates of wash. But compared in my lab with a single sheet or multiple sheets in a tray, with my normal water flow at 68 degrees, I've gotten 50% lower time in the wash water than I get with TF4 or TF5. And that is tested with hyporetention and with silver retention kits. The other interesting thing about the Super Universal Fix is that it's also compounded in such a way that if mixed with ferric EDTA, it now becomes a color film blix. So I'm using information that I learned during the development of our patent on color film blixes in this technology. It not only swells the film, but it accelerates the bleaching and fixing reaction in color films. There are instructions included with the Super Universal Fix that will tell the person how to make up a bleach fix.
Wow, pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, well, we've got some other stuff coming. Little smiley inserted here.
Well, I'm sure you're always working on something. I mean, Ron's definitely not sitting down relaxing.
No. Do you want to hear some other chemical stuff that Bud and I are working on?
If you want to talk about it, we'd love to hear about it, buddy. You bet.
Okay. If you go to their website and look in the new products area, you will see that Bud is now supplying 4x5 and 8x10 glass plates for dry plates. These are exactly cut. They are polished beautifully on the edges, so you won't cut your fingers. They're very high-quality glass. Bud sent me a complimentary packet of them to try out. Unfortunately, because of the summer slipping through my fingers like sand, I haven't been able to coat anything. But I've got a small complimentary packet of them here to try out when I get back to coating. They look beautiful. They do fit my plate holders just perfectly. I have a pile of 4x5 plate holders. He's also got on his shelves tetraazaindene, which is a stabilizer for making emulsions, and phenylmercaptotetrazole, or PMT as we call it, which is an emulsion stabilizer, and an antifoggant. So he's starting to introduce the chemicals necessary for emulsion makers and the ancillary things like plates for coating the emulsions they make. While I was there this spring, I taught Bud how to make emulsions. Last year, when I was there, I taught one of his staff members to make emulsions. So now he himself and one of his staff members are trained in making several different types of emulsions. And if they should wish to do it, they could very easily make up a batch of emulsions. I don't know if he plans to get into it, but I think it's more along the lines of supplying the chemicals and equipment needed to make emulsions. Right now, he's got some other things in mind. There are a number of chemicals that he has that don't show up on his catalog, that I would urge interested emulsion makers to ask about. They may be available there. I've seen the bottles on the shelf, so he is stocking up on things that might be of use sometime in the near future.
What have you found, Ron, with the interest in people making their own emulsions besides, of course, doing plate work where they're coating glass plate and so forth, historic process, but what have you found people wanting to make and coat their own film in their own paper?
Well, that's pretty complicated to answer. I think you will see some beautiful photographs on Denise Ross's website. She is doing great work in this. She has done both glass plate and paper coatings. I'm not sure exactly which direction she's going to be going next, but it doesn't matter. Her work is all good. Kirk Kias has coated plates and film. A number of other of my students have tried it and found it to be too complicated at the current stage of film availability. In other words, they know how to do it, they're willing to do it, but it's a lot easier to buy a good roll of film off the shelf than to make up your own.
Sure.
So we've got people in the wings waiting to see what happens to the analog market. We've got other people who are jumping into it just because it's a lot of fun, and other people jumping into it because it's a terrific art medium to work in. Those are the three ways. I've mentioned before, I think, in an interview with you, that what may be happening is that the large format and ultra-large format people may be forced in a not-too-distant future to coat their own materials. If you can't buy 10 by 20 film and you can't get it cut somehow, you can certainly coat it. And I have made two custom-made coating blades for people who wanted to coat that wide and that long. I think that glass plates may be a refuge for the ultra-large format people, too. And if this becomes so, I see people beginning to make old-fashioned plate holders made to order, and the price will start to drop. I know that Mark Osterman at George Eastman House has developed a method of turning a regular 4x5 foam holder into a 4x5 plate holder. By our last lunch, he had one there and showed it to me. It holds one 4x5 plate. And it's terrifically easy to do. You just cut the septum out and put a little wire brad in each corner to hold the plate. Works just like a charm.
Wow, that is cool. Because it's very difficult to find true plate holders, and if you buy new ones, they're very costly.
Yes, well, at some shops that specialize in old equipment, you can buy plates anywhere from $10 to $30 a piece. You will have to recondition them when you get them because they may not be in the greatest shape. You can buy new handcrafted ones, but 4x5 ones, I think, will run you up as high as $400 a piece.
Wow.
That's a pretty penny to pay for a plate holder. But if the demand goes up, the cost is going to come down. This spring, I brought a package of my plate holders to Montana with me, and Bud and I very carefully examined them to see if they are reproducible. And Bud feels that they can be reproduced, but he's not sure what the cost would be. For those of you that know Bud, you have seen the beautiful woodwork that he does. He built the buildings for the formulary, by the way, if you've seen a picture of the place. And he's built much of the furniture in the building. So he's a terrific woodworker. And if anybody can give an estimate of what can be done, he would. It's just that this delicate work is beyond his current scheme of things. He does not build tiny things. He builds buildings.
Right, skill saws and 2x4s and big pieces of lumber. I mean, making plate holders, like you said, is sort of intricate cabinet work type of woodworking. I mean, it's amazing this stuff costs $400 to have one made, but it's such a small quantity deal, I guess, it's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. And then when you look at an old wood plate holder, you see it's made up with about 4 to 8 tongue and groove joints, laminated pieces of very thin wood to hold things together, and to get the right placement of the plate at the focal plane of the camera and everything. Very, very, very delicate work. So the formulary is developing what you might say a gradual step-by-step introduction into emulsion making through supplying a group of chemicals that are used specifically for the emulsion making process. For those that are interested, I know that Bud can get several chemicals. I mentioned before that he has a number of them that aren't in a catalog or that he can get. He can get erythrosin, a sensitizing dye. He can get rhodium, which is used to control contrast. Or for those that are willing to handle more, let's say, poisonous chemicals, he can get cadmium for those that are willing to risk it. So there are a number of different chemicals that he could get. Whether he's willing to order them or not would be up to him and the customer interested. I know that many people cannot go to a company and buy these chemicals. So Bud would be a good starting place. Now, as far as where I am, I'm still doing emulsion research here.
Yep.
I have achieved a 100-speed emulsion based on the one that I taught my students, which is 40-speed. It is now a two-step emulsion and can achieve 100-speed, but it has quite a bit of solarization. Somebody pointed that out to me, and I thought it was a coating defect, but it turned out that it was real. And so I've been working on the solarization, and this may require draconian methods, which include addition of iridium solution. So I'm working on that right now, and I've been able to reconstruct from memory a 400-speed emulsion that is a graded iodide, or what might be called a core shell emulsion. So I'm working on it, and I guess where I stand with all of these people, everybody wants me to publish all of my formulas or give them my formulas. And I would be so happy to do it. But Scott, if I can enter a little commercial note here.
Please do.
It cost me $13,000 to develop the coating blades because they had to be made in prototype first. Then they had to be developed to the next stage, and there were three versions of them. And finally, a production run had to be made. And this all cost me about $13,000. And the emulsion making to date cost me close to the same amount. And this is because of silver nitrate and all of the other chemicals. I've got shelf upon shelf of exotic chemicals down next to my darkroom. And being retired, I simply can't afford to do it. I can't afford to do the development work and then sit down and give it away. But by the same token, I don't want to make a profit. So therefore, what I do, I do profit-free. So the blades are being sold at cost with nothing more than what Bud charges for handling and shipping. That's the way it goes. So there is no profit involved in this. And when I give the course, if you consider travel and everything like that, there is really no profit involved in teaching the course either. In fact, there's a little bit of a loss there, and that's one of the reasons why I've pretty much given up the workshop. It's such an effort for practically no return that I've given up.
Well, you need to charge more money then. People need to pay more. I mean, come on, they got to cover your time and your expenses. I mean, you can't go all the way from Rochester to out in the boonies in Montana and teach all this stuff for free.
Bud pays a fair set amount to every instructor there. He sets the fee, and I have no complaint about it. The students still say that it's too high. And this is not my concern. I have to say, well, I priced it out here. If I gave you a course in my home and considered the consumption of silver nitrate, we'd use about a pound of silver nitrate in a week, and my wife would make lunches for us, and I think on 2 days we have a dinner here too because we go so late. But anyhow, consumption of all the chemicals, heat, light, hot water, everything, totals up to about $1,000. That's not cheap.
No, but where can you go and have hands-on instruction by a master of your level for $1,000? It's unheard of.
Yeah, I don't charge that much. I only charge about $900.
So if they want to come and have Ron train them hands-on, this is like about a three-day gig, right?
No, it's 5 days.
Five days, that should be at least $3,000. I mean, you can't go anywhere and do a five-day hands-on one-on-one course for any kind of money less than that.
Well, we start at 8 o'clock, go till noontime, come upstairs, my wife has lunch ready. We eat lunch while the film or paper dries. We go back downstairs, and we make prints. And that's the way the day goes. And then after that, we come up, and if it's a long day, we'll have dinner here. If it isn't, we just evaluate the prints, and then the student goes back to wherever he's staying, hotel or motel. We've gone as late as 9 o'clock here. So it's a five-day gig. We start actually Sunday afternoon and finish Friday afternoon, which is the same schedule that the formulary holds to. And that just about works right. I am not presently giving any workshops here at home. It turned out to be so expensive, I gave that up too. You're right, it's too expensive for the price that people are willing to pay. This is why I worry about it dying out. I can't afford to give the workshops. I got into an argument on the internet with somebody who said some pretty nasty things about me charging for these. The thing is, a bottle of silver nitrate for that week cost me close to $300. I don't get it free.
Right.
And then all of the other stuff, I've got to pay the city for heat, light, electricity, and my water heater is going constantly. I had to have an extra large water heater put in because we're consuming so much water.
I can't see how someone can complain about you having to charge to instruct people how to do this. What kind of fool would even open their mouth and stick their foot in it to expect someone to do all this work for free? I don't even understand that. I couldn't even conceive that. Who would be stupid enough to say that?
I can conceive it, and I understand it, Scott, because there are masters who give free workshops, but they're a different type. They are kind of the type where everybody meets out at some park, like Yellowstone, and they have the master walk with them and point out to them, this is a good scene. This is where I would set my camera up. Why don't you set your camera up here, take a few shots, this is the exposure I'd use for the following films. That's a free workshop, where a master is giving instruction, but nothing is consumed.
Yeah, but that's not a workshop. That's just some guy telling you how to take pictures.
When you've got a terrific artist, and he's teaching you, and you are using all your own materials, that's a master teaching you.
Well, this is true, but if you're out in the woods, and you're in Yellowstone or Yosemite, and you have someone telling you what to do, I would rather pay the gentleman or whoever it is and say, I really think this is a good place to do it, and this is why. And this tree should be over here because this is why. Not just tell you, here, set your camera up here, point it here, 1/100th at f/16, and you're good to go. He might as well just hand you negatives that he already made, and everybody can go home.
I think that the explanation would go beyond what I did. I was simplifying. I think that he might do what you're explaining.
Yeah.
He might say, now, the reason for doing this is, look at where the clouds are. They're just at the right height over that mountaintop.
And I would never expect him to do that for free.
Yeah, well, my question is, who's going to pay for his transportation to Yosemite?
Someone. That's why you got to charge. I mean, people have to be compensated. It's too expensive anymore. It's astronomical what it costs to even live. Never mind go on trips to teach people for free.
Yes, you're right. I was struck by a joke on APUG the other day. How do you double the price of a Yugo? You fill it with gas. Now, I don't mean to disparage the Yugo. I'm just saying that strikes me because the cost of gasoline has gone up. And just living, I'm astounded at the price of food at the local grocery store when I go shopping. Things are just going sky high. And as I said, I'm retired. I'm on a fixed income. I've got to make do. And what I've decided is, I can still barely scrape out R&D here for bud and process chemistry and for emulsion chemistry, and that's about it. I can't teach workshops either there or here because it eats up too much of my time, energy, and money. That's the way it is. As far as my R&D goes, I told you I was working on a 100-speed emulsion and a 400-speed emulsion. I'm going to hold the book until I finish those two because the comments that people made who have read the book or have proofed it have said, you need a little bit more. You've got to go a little bit further into the modern era. Denise Ross put it very well. She's working on a 1925s type emulsion, and I'm working on a 45. And I said to her in response today that I was working up as near as the 60s. I am, and I think I'm going to push it as far as Pumped makes, and then that's going to have to end the emulsion-making book. And then I'll be able to put everything together in one piece and cover everything from about 1910 or 1920 up through about 1965. I look for the book to be finished on that basis probably in March or April, which is a little later than I'd wanted to. Then I have to get approval from several different sources who hold the copyright to some material that I have included in the book.
Well, hopefully the book's not free.
Do you know something? There's been so much talk about it. I've actually considered that as a possibility, is to just put it up online and let it be free. I've said, I don't want to worry about it. It's so much trouble. But the DVDs can't be free because it costs a lot to duplicate them.
And the DVDs are going to be part of the book project, so it's all sort of one gig.
Right. The DVDs are totally done. They've been reviewed by half a dozen people who have said, wow, great, good, freeze it, that's it. But the people who have read the book have said, you've got to move this a little bit this way, you've got to nudge it a little bit that way, and so forth. So I'm doing what they've suggested.
Yeah, I still think that this stuff should be packaged together and people need to pay for this kind of knowledge, because it's just, you can't get it anywhere and you can't even put a value on it. It's so valuable that people need to step up to the pay window. I mean, nothing is free and everybody has to live. I can't conceive that people actually complain about the price of one-on-one workshops and the price of these things, because the information that you're supplying to the photographic community has no value on it. It's beyond value. It's beyond a dollar amount. You can't get this anywhere. And I can't believe that people are that cheap and whine about this.
Well, during the making of the DVD, I was weighing out silver nitrate to make one of the emulsions. And I remarked over my shoulder to the camera that the amount of silver nitrate that I was weighing out and the other chemicals probably was costing me more than I was paying the videographer that was doing the work. And I got a kind of a little unhappy chuckle from behind the camera that you could hear in the background. So, yeah, just the DVD cost a lot of money, though, to have somebody come in and stand behind the camera and take it for you.
I just can't believe people are that cheap. That just blows me away.
I'm looking back on what we've been talking about, and I've sounded awfully commercial.
Well, no, you haven't. I mean, come on, you're developing all this great stuff. You can buy it at the formulary. You can use the product. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being commercial, okay? You're making this stuff up that you can't get anywhere else. You have decades and decades of chemical engineering knowledge that no one else has on this planet, and you're making these things up. There's no problem being commercial, and I think people want to hear about this stuff. They want to use these great new chemicals that you're developing. They want to learn how to make their own emulsions, and you don't need to be worried about being commercial, because this is how life is, and if people want to use these great products, they're going to have to pay.
Yeah, you're right. We have a Kodak newsletter, a retirees newsletter. That's two newsletters, a Kodak newsletter that comes from Kodak itself.
Right.
And then a retirees newsletter that is only to retirees. And they publish in their in memorial service to current serving Kodakers and retiring Kodakers. And it's amazing to see the list of people vanishing from the world and going to that great dark room in the sky. An estimate that I have is approximately 200 photo engineers left in the world. That includes Fuji, Ilford, Kodak, people who are actually capable of practicing this entire science. And I was just one of the middle guys. I was not one of the top guys. I could name 10 people that were much more advanced in their understanding of photo engineering than myself. And they've published a lot of writings on this. But we're vanishing one by one. When we are gone, you will have to reconstruct analog photography from approximately 1920 onward. And many of the textbooks are wrong or poorly written or ambiguous or purposely misleading.
Really?
Yes, that's true. Now, there may be reasons, but there's been a lot of talk about the BIOS reports. That's the British Intelligence something-something reports that were published about AGFA at the end of World War II, in which AGFA purportedly yielded up all of their formulas. I've read some of these, and I've found them to be quite ambiguous and not revealing at all. In many of them, they will just merely say the silver nitrate is gatekept. That means tipped or poured. Now, I know that AGFA didn't just pour silver nitrate into a salt solution. They timed it, and they had a specific mixing rate and all of this, because Kodak did, unless AGFA was so primitive. And I can't believe that chemists from Germany would be so sloppy as to not prescribe a mix rate and a pour rate.
No, they just didn't put the stuff in there, because who they were.
But that's right, and it would go on with a whole list of English chemicals. And then they'd ask him what X1 was, and the German would respond, "Hier ist unbekannt." Here, that's unknown. I don't know what it is. And I'm saying, I knew that Kodak used code names for all of its chemicals, but if I was that highly placed, I would have a code deciphering list that the interrogator would have insisted on using to decipher it. You can't just say it's unknown. You're head of the plant, man. You know what it is. So people are asking me, well, what did this say? I can't answer them. I can't tell them this was phenylmercaptotetrazole. I'm picking that out of the sky because the reports say over and over again, X1 is unknown. But I can't believe that personally, professionally, because even at my mid-level, if I had to know what was in a given solution, I could go to the main office, they would open up the safe, draw out the sheet, and I would look up X1, and there would be the name. It is so many moles per liter of this and that and the other thing. It's inconceivable that this could happen. But there's no way now that we can identify what those things were in the reports. I have had half a dozen people ask me for the reports. I have seen them at Kodak. I've seen them at several places. They're very interesting to read, but very cryptic. And I must add, too, that based on posts on APUG, there must be at least two, if not more, variants on every formula, because people disagree what the formula is all about.
Right, because it's all a bunch of misinformation they put out, not wanting to give out the truth.
I'm convinced that in some cases they've given good information, but incomplete. Let's keep a few secrets ourselves. In some places, they've given the information so widely separated that it would take years of study to combine them and come up with the whole formula.
Sure.
And it's easier for me to go back and remember a formula that I coded at Kodak than it is for me to go back to the library, look up a BIOS report, write down that formula, then get all the references in it, and go to the next report and look up that formula and get all the references to it. And you see what I'm saying? Going on and on and on, just trying to decipher what's going on there. I know what I coded. I'd have to decipher what AGFA coded.
Well, I think this is why people need to stop whining about helping to support people that have this kind of knowledge. And I think that hopefully we can help push some of these things into people wanting to learn this type of technology and this stuff not get lost. Because like you said, you guys that know this stuff are getting older and nobody's getting younger. So eventually things happen and this information goes by the wayside and it's gone forever.
It recalled something. I was thinking back to the discussion we had on coding at Kodak.
Yep.
I remembered something that I really should have brought out in that people aren't aware of. But as you roll a coating of film or paper up on itself, if it doesn't have an overcoat, the cinching of the roller, the tightening of the roll,
yep,
will cause abrasion and fogging. And you get little fogged lines on the surface of the film or paper. So you put an overcoat on to prevent this. To do that, though, you have to put the overcoat on either with a slide hopper or before you roll the roll up. So you have to have two coating heads on the machine. But then when you roll it up, instead of getting cinch marks that are fog, you get cinch marks that are abrasions. It's like putting a bunch of ripe peaches into a basket. You ever try to do that?
Well, you're going to bruise everything up. Everything is going to get chafed, and it's not going to be a happy scene.
That's right. We had 6 peach trees in our backyard when I was a kid. And I used to have to pick the peaches and very gently place them into baskets for my family. Well, film is very much like that. You put an overcoat on, you get rid of the fog from the abrasion, but you get abrasion marks. And so you have to put a lubricant into the top layer that prevents this abrasion marking as the film is rolled up and is kept rolled. If film sits too long on rollers, on some sort of a support, you fog it from pressure, so you have to hang it from the center of the roll. You don't set a roll of film down on itself. It crushes it and fogs it. So you have to have film hanging like meat in a cold meat locker. So these are things that didn't come out, and I'm thinking of thousands of things that go into this that have to be passed on to the next generation of film coders, of emulsion makers, all of the above, and it just isn't getting done. They don't know what goes into the overcoat. We've never discussed that on any forum. What goes into an emulsion to stabilize it properly? I teach my students how to make an emulsion that will keep for about a year. But I don't go into making emulsions that will keep for 10, 20, 30 years. I'm going to have to do some of that, too, in a sense, to add to the book. That's another chapter that people suggested. So there you have it in a nutshell, kind of wrapping everything up. I'm working on new developers and fixers with Bill Troop and Bud Wilson over at the Formulary. I'm working on new emulsions and emulsion prep methods and a couple of new chapters for the book or extensions to existing chapters. And I'm not doing any workshops because I've found them to be totally cost ineffective because either people don't want to pay what they're really worth, and I just don't feel like charging that much, pay for what they're really worth.
Well, I think you charge what they're really worth. I think people will still come. Sometimes if it's not expensive enough, it doesn't look like it's worthwhile.
Okay. I'm going to get some ideas from that, Scott.
I'm telling you, good things cost a lot. Good lenses cost a lot. Good food costs a lot. I mean, nothing's free.
But let me make a point of something here that may put this in perspective for you. People will spend $500, maybe $1,000 for a real good camera. They will spend $1 a sheet to $2 a sheet for good 4x5 sheet film, or $5 for a roll of Kodachrome. But when it comes to processing, they want to use dishwasher fluid instead of PhotoFlow. The cheapest doggone chemical you can buy, PhotoFlow, one bottle for, what, $5 or $7, something like that, will last you a lifetime. I've got a gallon of PhotoFlow 600 that I will never use. I could give it out to every photographer on APUG and for a penny a bottle and still make a profit. And they will use it for the rest of their lives. And yet a lot of them would rather use dishwasher fluid. And I tell you, that's going to ruin their film eventually because it's got all kinds of oils and scents and dyes and everything in it. They don't notice it, but eventually it's going to start doing something to their film or paper. PhotoFlow is absolutely chemically pure and harmless to film. And I'm not recommending just PhotoFlow. There are a number of companies that make excellent film wedding agents.
Right.
So it's the idea of the purity of the chemistry rather than the type of the chemistry that's used.
Well, hopefully we can get some of these people around that'll want to pay for this stuff. I still can't believe people complain. I just don't understand, but that's me. Nevertheless, we're going to hopefully get people up on top of their game here and want to learn more about emulsion making and these great chemicals that you're doing. Ron, tell me where people find out about all this great new stuff that you're doing with the guys over at the Formulary.
Well, they can contact Sherry at the Formulary. Their number is on their website, which is photoformulary.com. Sherry is very happy to spend some time with you to explain what they've got, what they don't, and what they have that isn't in their catalog. I'd like to add a little tail end on here by saying that analog photo sales and chemical sales from start to finish, not just the Formulary, but at Kodak, at all of the companies that I know of, are down drastically again this last quarter. So I know that they will welcome your business at the Photo Formulary too, just as they will at Kodak if you buy Kodak film and chemicals.
You're right.
Sherry will help you. If you contact me over APUG, I get roughly 20 messages a day. I'd be glad to help. I answer all messages.
No, this is great stuff, and I do appreciate it and look forward to chatting again here about a bunch of other stuff that you're working on. We're going to be talking about some of the work you're doing with the guys over the George Eastman House. And of course, Ron, just a great resource that you're spending all this time helping to educate people in this traditional photographic process, spending your time on APUG and just all this great work you're doing, buddy. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to help. I want to see analog photography prosper. That, I think, is the bottom line of everything I've said today. I want to see analog photography prosper.
And hopefully we can get Ron to prosper a little bit, too. So there you go. Great stuff, buddy. And I do look forward to talking to you here soon and continuing our chats here on Inside Analog Photo.
It was good to talk to you, Scott, and I'd be glad to talk again anytime.
Well, there you go. Ron Mowry, great stuff that he's doing with the guys over at the Formulary. Very cool new development products, and I think even more so what Ron is giving back, how he's helping people extend this. And I think people should really think about going to Ron's classes. They need to buy Ron's book. People need to help people that are helping you. People take for granted. Ron's doing this for the love of photography, and you can definitely look forward to having more Ron Mowry on the program. Beautiful stuff Ron's doing. And next time we're going to talk to Ron about his photography, his time at Cape Canaveral, and a lot of other great stuff. So definitely check out what he's doing over at APUG and just help support what he's doing, because what he's doing, no one else is doing in the industry. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful, over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com, and of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org, our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.